The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Diana Martyr. I'm a reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer and a fan of our author tonight, Jeanette Conant. It's a pleasure for me to introduce her. As a reporter, I can tell you that it's one thing to know a good story is out there, lurking, waiting to be told. But it's quite another matter to ask the right questions, to find the revealing documents, and it's yet another accomplishment to put it all together, to make that story an intriguing page-turner that will resonate with readers. Our guest tonight, Jeanette Conant, is just such a writer. Her 2002 bestseller, Tuxedo Park, was sparked in part by her grandfather, who was the president of Harvard University and went on to be the administrator of the Manhattan Project. So he had some nice connections. He knew Albert Loomis, for example, the subject of Tuxedo Park. And it's always nice to have connections. But Jeanette Conant's masterful storytelling goes way beyond having those sources. Tuxedo Park and now A Covert Affair are a tribute to her skill as an investigative reporter, her ability to make sources, and her determination to uncover the right documents. All that plus narrative talent is what you get with Jeanette Conant. In A Covert Affair, she introduces us to a tall, gangly, kind of insecure woman from California named Julie McWilliams. This is the woman we'll come to know and love as Julia Child. But as Julie McWilliams, she takes a job as a file clerk for a government agency at one of the most dangerous points in America's history, December 1942. In short order, Julie meets Paul Child, and together they befriend a colleague by the name of Jane Foster, who will have the power to turn their lives upside down. That's all I'm going to tell you about the story. You can hear the rest directly from the author and later by reading the book. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Jeanette Conant.
Thank you all for coming tonight. Thank you for your introduction. Well, over the last few weeks, I've been traveling around the country talking about this book, and it's been quite a lot of fun because people have been very surprised to learn that their beloved Julia Child once worked for an intelligence agency. And when I was in Washington the other week, one fan of hers came up to me and said, "No, no, no, it can't be true. There's no way the author of Mastering French Cooking was a master spy." And USA Today did an article in which they speculated that perhaps bon appetit was a secret code word. I think some of the amusement and surprise comes from the fact that when people think of Julia Child, you know, all 6'2" of her, and that incredible operatic voice, you know that she was not operating incognito anywhere. And I think some of that sort of confusion stems from the fact that when people think of the OSS, which is the Office of Strategic Services, they tend to think of it a little bit in Hollywood terms, you know, the grainy black and white images of people parachuting behind enemy lines into occupied France. And that's not, you know, wholly accurate, because the OSS, for those of you that don't know, was organized very hastily in the early days of the war by President Roosevelt, and it was our first attempt at a foreign intelligence service. All we had up till then was the FBI, which was a domestic police force. And our European allies were begging us to become more sophisticated about the fact that there were all these Nazi spies infiltrating South America and the United States, and that we had to do something about it, and that we were very naive and ill-equipped to fight this threat. So the OSS was organized with great haste, and it was you know, essentially an enormous intelligence gathering operation, an enormous bureaucracy. And of the 13,000 people that eventually worked there, the vast majority never left Washington, let alone their desks. That said, though, the fact that so many of the things that the OSS did could be conducted from behind a desk meant that it had offered very rare opportunities for women for advancement. So you got some very interesting and extraordinary women who worked for the OSS, and Julia Child was one of those. Now, most people want to know, the first thing they want to know is, why did I end up writing this book? How did I come about doing this research? And the answer to that is quite easy. I read about Julia Child being a spy the way everybody else did in the newspaper. I was in Washington, and I saw a headline. It said, Spy's Secret Recipe. And that caught my attention. It was the fall of 2008, and I was in Washington on a book tour for my last book called The Irregulars, which was about a group of British spies in Washington and the early days of the OSS. And it was the same week that the National Archives released a huge cache of classified documents. And these were documents that revealed this huge civilian and military network, thousands of people who had secretly worked for the OSS during the war when we were under the threat of the Nazis and fascism. And there were all kinds of names in this list that were revealed that were really unlikely kind of James Bond figures. You had Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg, Jr. You had the famous historian Arthur Schlesinger, Jr. You had White Sox catcher Mo Berg worked for the OSS. You had the actor Sterling Hayden. And, of course, most unusual of all was Julia Child. Because of that, her name caught people's attention, and it was in headlines across the country. So everywhere I went on this book tour, people came up to me and said, well, can you tell us what kind of spy was Julia Child? Where did she go? What did she do? What on earth does any of this have to do with cooking? And so I realized that there was a certain curiosity out there, and I couldn't answer any of those questions, and I started doing the research. And what I discovered, to my surprise, was not one spy story, but two. And I thought it would make a wonderful book. And that's how I got here. Now, like so many wartime secrets, the basic outline of Julia's OSS career could be looked up as easily as the ingredients to one of her recipes. It had sort of leaked out over the years. It was mentioned, certainly in her obituaries. She gave the brief outline of it in her memoir, My Life in France, that was published a few years before she died. And some reporters who tripped onto the fact asked her about it late in life, and she would answer, well, they would say, were you a spy? And she would say, well, what's a spy? And wink and not answer the question. And the reason for the caginess wasn't just to be cute. People who took their oath of secrecy when they joined the OSS took that oath very, very seriously. And in fact, of the dozens and dozens of people that I interviewed in doing this book and the previous book, many of their children never knew they worked for the OSS. They never spoke about it at any time until the government released those documents. And those documents had been something that reporters and historians had been wanting to get their hands on for a long time. The OSS was disbanded at the end of the war in 1945. So it had been a long wait, and people had been pressing to get their hands on these OSS files. And the CIA had been resistant, and it actually took a former CIA director and an OSS veteran, William Casey, to put through the legislation to have them released. And that was in 1981. And we know Washington does everything in a hurry. So it wasn't until the fall of 2008 that last 750,000 documents, the OSS personnel files, were declassified. And Julia Child's 134-page classified service record was among those papers, and I jumped on it right away. Now, the first thing that was apparent to me in reading through her personnel file was that Julia was not Mata Hari material. As desperate as she was to be a spy, she had none of the qualifications. In fact, she wrote in her diary that she felt like a very plain person with no talents at all. This was 1942, and Julia Child was very different than the woman that we come to think of today. She was 30. She was unemployed. She was single, and she had a series of failed career attempts behind her. She'd graduated from Smith College. She'd had very good education, and she thought she was going to become a great lady novelist. And she'd moved to New York and tried to work for The New Yorker, and all of her story submissions were rejected. So she'd ended up returning to California somewhat disappointed. She tried a career in advertising and got fired, which was very humiliating for her. And when the war broke out, she was living in California, tending house for her widowed father. He was a wealthy Pasadena rancher, and she was spending her time playing golf and tennis. And she wrote in her diary that, you know, she was a big girl, and she thought she was going to have a big destiny. And when it didn't materialize, she was very disappointed in herself. So when the war broke out, it wasn't just her chance to do her patriotic duty, but it was a real chance at a second opportunity to make something of herself. And she seized it with both hands. She was tall. She was very athletic. She'd grown up hunting in the Hollywood Hills with her brothers. And so she thought she would be great and natural for the Army and Navy Reserves. She right away filled out the forms, expecting to hear that she would get in, and she got rejected. The official form that she received said that she was too tall to serve her country. And she was bitterly disappointed. She ended up, like so many women, in the vast typist pools. They were starting all of these wartime agencies. They needed endless amounts of clerical help. And these wartime girls, these Washington girls, came in by the thousands and were assigned to a desk, and you typed all day. It was really dreary work. She hated it. She was in the Office of War Information. And she decided to work like a demon to get promoted. And she did. And through friends, she finagled her way into the office of William Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, this wonderfully tall, charismatic Irish Catholic who was a much decorated World War I hero who was starting this shadowy new agency that nobody knew much about. And Julia was delighted to find herself in his office. She loved the OSS right away. Everybody in Washington was talking about it and whispering about it, and it had quite a elitist reputation. The word was that Donovan, who was a corporate lawyer, had gone out of his way just to do what lawyers always do. He'd hired a bunch of other lawyers. And when he finished hiring lawyers, he'd hired their brothers from the best schools across the country. So you had all these Harvard and Princeton and Yale professors coming in to do espionage work, and they were a very strange crew. You know, they were archaeologists and anthropologists and mathematicians and psychologists. If you were an ornithologist and you had chased a rare bird across Burma, he made you Burma section chief. Didn't matter if your expertise was in feathers, you were now an expert in Burma. And so there was a lot of carping going on in Washington that Donovan just hired from the Ivy League and the Junior League, and the OSS became known as Oh So Swish and Oh So Swell. But really, you know, there was some logic to this. Donovan was charged with organizing this enormous intelligence agency virtually overnight. And most of the people who would have been logical to work in intelligence gathering were already working for military and naval intelligence. So he had to be creative about finding talent. And he also knew that he needed some special requirements for this job. He liked people that had private money. He was under the impression that if you came from a good family and you had an income, you would be harder to bribe. So he definitely did go out of his way to hire certain kinds of people. Also, it's important to remember that our country was pulling itself out of the Depression. And in the early 1940s, very few Americans traveled abroad. In fact, nobody in Congress had been abroad, if you can believe that, in 1940. So most people who had language skills, who had grown up in Europe, who might have a French mother, who had gone back and forth, who spoke the language, who had contacts and knew the lay of the land, were probably well-to-do. So there was some method to his madness, but he took a lot of flack for it then and later, as you will see. But Julia felt right at home. These were people like herself. They were people that had gone to the Seven Sisters Colleges. And, in fact, shortly after she was hired, somebody told her that Donovan's idea of the perfect female employee was a cross between a Smith graduate, a Powers model, and a Katie Gibbs girl. And she wrote in her diary, "Finally, I have the right qualifications for a job." She was in Donovan's office a very short time before she got transferred to one of the harebrained schemes that the OSS backed. Now, the OSS backed every kind of imaginative war effort. You could go in and pitch an idea to Donovan, and he would underwrite it. He had no cap on his funds. He did not have to pass anything by Congress for approval. He answered only to the president, and he funded some really wild ideas. And Julia was assigned to one of them right away, and it was called the Emergency Sea Rescue Division. She worked for an eminent Harvard zoologist named Harold Jefferson Coolidge. And her job was to help develop rescue kits for pilots who had been shot down and were flailing away in the sea waiting for a plane to come swoop them up. And her particular responsibility was to go to the fish market every morning at dawn and get the fresh catch so that they could spend the day squeezing it and making a very stinky repellent that the pilots could rub on to protect them from shark attacks. She thought it was divine work. She loved her colleagues and was thrilled. While she was in the OSS, she was meeting all of these very eccentric people. She'd never met all these ivory tower academics before. She'd certainly never met women like this before. She met a leading female anthropologist like Cora Dubois from Harvard. She was hanging out with Gregory Bateson, who was one of the most famous anthropologists of the day. He was married to someone called Margaret Mead. Even more attractive, he was something like 6'7", and Julia had quite a crush on him. But these were really brilliant people, and she wrote in her diary, finally, I have found my place in the world. So she loved her colleagues, and she was actually quite disappointed when she was recalled to Donovan's office. But while she was there, she started to meet a couple of women that I write about in this book, and one of them was almost her sort of mirror opposite, and her name was Jane Foster. She was exactly the same age as Julia Child, and like Julia, she was from a wealthy, conservative California family. She was from San Francisco, and she had all the right pedigree and background that made her someone that the OSS would recruit easily and could vet easily and know would be discreet. But unlike Julia, Jane Foster was a very, very outgoing, confident, adventurous woman, very sexually adventurous. She'd already had an early marriage to a Dutch diplomat. She'd lived all over the world, and she spoke a number of languages, including fluent Malay. And she was being trained as a counterintelligence agent that they wanted to slip behind the lines because of her languages. So she was very bold, very adventurous, and Julia was really in awe of Jane Foster. And when word came out that these agents that had been training in Washington were going to be sent overseas, she was green with envy. Julia, as you can imagine, wanted to be sent to France. She thought it would be grand to be an agent in France. 17 years of high school and college French, she couldn't speak a word. So there was no chance of that. And she was terribly disappointed that she was going to sit out the war as a glorified secretary when Donovan came down the halls one day and said he was looking for warm bodies, any bodies, to come work in 5 rear echelon intelligence bases that were being built in the China-Burma-India theater. Julia didn't care where she went as long as she got out of Washington, and she raised her hand. It was wartime. There was a man shortage. They needed women who were willing to rough it overseas, and so Julia got to go. Now, her first posting was supposed to be India, and she was on the boat to India with the first group of OSS agents that were going to build this first intelligence base in New Delhi when they got their travel orders changed. The reason for that was that Lord Louis Mountbatten, the very dashing royal that had been made head of SEAC, Southeast Asia Command, combined operations for the whole head of the China-Burma-India theater, visited New Delhi and thought it was a very hot and dirty place to wage war, thought it would be nicer to have his headquarters someplace more attractive and cooler, and he picked Kandy, Ceylon. Now, Julia was rerouted to Kandy, Ceylon, and this was not a hardship post. It was an old tea planter's oasis. It was nestled high in the mountains of Ceylon, and it had to be at least 1,000 miles from the nearest fighting in Burma. And it was picture postcard pretty. It had all these little Buddhist temples. It had a pretty little lake. And instead of roughing it in some kind of tents, she lived in a huge British colonial hotel with 4 poster beds and mosquito netting, and it looked very grand. The fact is there was no plumbing, and the place was full of mosquitoes, so they all got dengue fever and were desperately ill for their first 3 weeks in Ceylon. But it didn't matter. It was all very exciting and glamorous to Julia. And the fact of the matter was the job that she was entrusted with turned out to be quite an important job. because of the OSS's proximity to the SEAC headquarters, this was the major hub of activity, and all of the generals met there to do their future planning for invasions and that whole war theater with Mountbatten and the British. So every OSS invasion plan, every operation crossed her desk, all of the cables from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, all of the coded cables. She had the code books, and she decoded most of the classified documents. She knew of every upcoming operation. She held the code names and the various aliases to all of the OSS agents working behind enemy lines. And she got to be a very experienced and trusted intelligence officer. In fact, she used to always be very modest about her responsibilities because there were so many people who were risking their necks every day in very, very dangerous operations that she would always be very modest about her job. But at the time, she would joke to people that she developed the top secret twitch from handling so much sensitive material. One of my favorite images of Julia Child is that one of her responsibilities was for paying their native agents. They ran all of these Indonesian and Thai and Kachin agents that would go behind enemy lines for them and report on Japanese troop movements. And when they came back and they filed their reports with Julia, she had to pay them. And she used what the OSS euphemistically called the operational payroll. That meant cutting from a big brown loaf of opium because they did not want U.S. currency, of course. And the local currency was worthless at that point. And Julia wouldn't bat an eye, and she would always say, "Oh, it looks like Boston brown bread." And she would slice off their salary and wrap it in wax paper and entrust them with that and put the rest in the safe. So she turned out to be as absolutely unflappable on the job then as she was later when she would drop chickens and dust them off. And she was beloved by her colleagues, when she won her war citation, one of the things it said was that morale in her unit was the very highest, and I think that largely had to do with her character and her humor. After a year in Ceylon, she was transferred to Kunming, China, and that was the very opposite of where she'd been. It was a really primitive outpost. It was deep in western China behind enemy lines at the foot of the Burma Road. It looked like a kind of a, you know, something like an old cowboy outpost. When they arrived, in fact, there were no tables and chairs, and they had their first meetings on the floor. It was dusty. It was dirty. It was grimy. It was remote. There was a very small group there. The food was terrible, and they had, spam for a breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And a lot of the people cracked under the pressure. She saw an awful lot of activity in the short time she was there. In the 6 months she was there, that region of China experienced a historic flood. It destroyed hundreds of villages in the area. It put their OSS camp under 4 feet of water, and they were commuting to the buildings in the rubber life raft boats that they rescued from planes. They were trying to put all their documents up high to save stuff. Everything they owned was wet. Droves of rats came from the countryside seeking high land, bringing with them cholera, a deadly epidemic, so that hundreds and hundreds of people were dying every day in the villages around them, and she would watch the bodies flow down the river from where she was working. They couldn't eat anything fresh. So as I said, it was spam and Dole pineapple 24 hours a day. And Paul Child, who was there at the same time designing war rooms for the Allied generals, he wrote about one after another of the young men in his company cracking from the pressure and the disease and the dysentery. And then he noted that Julia was a good scout, that nothing fazed her, and that she carried on, and that everybody just adored her. So you can kind of imagine what she was like. She would write later that the war made me, and I think that it was her political and personal coming of age. She came from being such a sheltered upper-class girl from Pasadena. She'd never been further outside the United States than Tijuana to this incredible experience. And she emerged from it a much more confident, self-possessed person with just a huge appetite and curiosity about life. And much of that really was due to Paul Child. Paul Child was the oddest possible person for Julia to fall in love with. She met him on the balcony of a tea planter's porch in Ceylon, and she was smitten almost immediately. And you have to say, Lord knows why. He was 10 years older, a head shorter, and an extremely difficult man. His colleagues considered him moody and a loner and a perfectionist and crabby. And Julia even confided in her diary shortly after meeting him, not an easy man. Paul had dropped out of college. He was a self-taught painter and sculptor, but he was very skilled with diagrams. He would do these incredibly elaborate war rooms. He could do a very sophisticated topographical maps out of modeling clay. And the war room he'd done for General Wedemeyer in Ceylon had been so brilliant that Mountbatten had taken one look at it and said, I want me one of those. And he ended up building them for the British and then all over the China-Burma-India theater, and he was very much in demand. Julia was just smitten with him, but Paul fancied himself quite the connoisseur. He had lived in France. He spoke fluent French. He liked very sophisticated women. He liked French food. He liked literature. He liked to argue about politics. And he thought Julia was a good kid. And he would spend hours and hours and hours telling her how much he loved the very beautiful and sophisticated Jane Foster, who spoke fluent French and had lived in France, and other of the OSS Mata Haris, who were very lovely and more to his liking. And Julia persevered, however. She didn't give up. And when Jane Foster was relegated to training Indonesian agents and she and Paul were transferred to China, Julia tried to monopolize his attentions. They were a very small group by then, and most of them had sort of paired off. Now, Paul, even though it was quite dangerous to leave the compound, he did not like to eat in the canteen. He had a very sophisticated palate, so he was always proposing a little bit dangerous trips out of bounds to some local Sichuan or Cantonese dive that was strictly non-regulation. And he was always looking for people to go with him. And then he would take a party in a borrowed Jeep, and off they'd go. And, of course, they'd have pig's knuckles and sweet and sour sauce, and they would have snails, and they would be desperately, desperately, desperately ill for about 10 days afterwards. There were all kinds of marvelous names for that, like the Yangtze Rapids and the Shanxi Shits, but you haven't had dinner, so. You can imagine that the number of people who volunteered to go on these outings dwindled, but Julia always put up her hand, and I think that's a real sign of true love. So in the end, it was only the two of them always going off to try these local delicacies, and they got to be fast friends. And Paul admitted in his diaries and his letters to his twin brother in Boston that she was really a good campaigner and very adventurous and bold, but she was he just saw her as a friend. By the time the war wound to an end in the fall of 1945, Julia confessed to Paul that she was head over heels, and he was still on the fence. And he suggested that they go their separate ways and maybe in a year take a good look at each other in civilian clothes. He felt that possibly wartime romances were a bad idea and that he and Julia had nothing in common. Paul Child was very left-wing, very bohemian, and he had a sort of a horror of her father, the Pasadena rancher, as it would turn out, with good reason. So they went their separate ways, and one of the most striking things about the book, and I think one of the greatest revelations for those of you that will read it, is what I call the epistolary romance that takes place between the two of them over the next 9 months. She returns home to California. He goes back to Washington, and they write. In the beginning, the letters are very formal, sort of how are you and what are you doing. And Julia decides that she will win Paul over, and she embarks on a sort of 9-month course of self-transformation. She's determined to turn herself into a woman that he will want to spend the rest of his life with. So to her father's dismay, she subscribes to the New York Times and the Washington Post, so she will have political ideas beyond the LA Times editorial page. She starts taking piano lessons because Paul is very musical. She takes semantics and psychology lessons because he thinks that she's got a slightly warped view of family life. She's reading the very sexy novels of Henry Miller at his suggestion. You can imagine why. And also at his suggestion, she's taking her very first cooking lessons. It is a sign of perhaps what a bad cook Julia was in 1946, that her first cooking lessons were two British women outside Los Angeles, and her first triumphs were scrambled eggs and pancakes. So she had a long way to go. She'd been from a wealthy family. They'd had a household cook, and Julia couldn't boil water. So she had to learn at the very beginning, and she was not a natural, as she confessed to Paul in her early letters. But she absolutely devotes herself to this course of study, reporting weekly on her progress at the piano and at the stove. And I think Paul was finally overwhelmed by her warmth, by her zest for life, by her determination. And I think he could also see that she was making good on her promise not to go back to being a social butterfly in Pasadena. So he finally agrees to come out and see her. And as she feared, it was pretty much hatred at first sight between her father and Paul Child. And she makes the rather brave decision that this is the man that she wants to spend her life with, and they will get married in the fall. Now, most people know the next chapter. Paul gets posted to France. Julia goes along. Paul, still not impressed with her cooking, suggests that she study at the Cordon Bleu school. And that is where Julia will fall in love with the French cuisine. And after 2 years of study there, begin to see the possibility of working on a cookbook with two very experienced French chefs that she meets in Paris and the beginnings of her career. What happened also to them in Paris is that they're reunited with any number of their OSS colleagues and the people they had served with, because there's a huge community of former OSS people working for the State Department in Paris. So they are reunited with Jane Foster, who is an artist living in Paris, and many of their other OSS colleagues, and those are their closest family and friends. And they attend all of Julia's experimental dinners and eat her failed souples, and they are all very close friends. What most people don't know about this period of time is that the enormous euphoria that followed victory in World War II was actually very short-lived, and that almost immediately after our victory, we headed into a rather scary time in the United States. Russia, which had been our ally, and we had not worried much about communists. They were fighting on our side. We were fighting, after all, the fascists and the Japanese. Suddenly decided to flex their muscles as a new superpower, and they started marching through Europe. And America was desperately pouring millions of dollars into Europe in the form of the Marshall Plan, trying to shore up all of these fledgling democracies in France and Italy, Germany, to keep communism from spreading, so that we were terrified that before we knew it, all of Europe would be communist. And in a very short time, really 6 months after the war ended, anti-communism became the catchword of not only our foreign policy, but really our cultural thermostat. It was the sole topic of debate in Congress. And as the 40s went on, it became more and more heated. And one of the things that touched it off was that in 1949, China fell to the communists, in the language of the day. We had been backing all this time Chiang Kai-shek. He had been fighting Mao Zedong and his agrarian revolutionaries, the communist forces. And in 1949, he declared the People's Republic of China, and Chiang Kai-shek had to flee to Taiwan. And the Truman administration was beside itself, and the country was beside itself. And Congress started to hold all these hearings asking how this could have happened. How could have our experts in China, during the war and afterwards, let us down so badly that another huge country would become communist? And suddenly, our leading State Department advisors in China during the war and our leading OSS advisors, who had been working closely with Mao Zedong and with Chiang Kai-shek and who had done much of the negotiating, were being hauled before congressional subcommittees and asked about this. And their wartime reports and records were being read out loud. And if they were all critical of Chiang Kai-shek, they were seen as being traitors to our interests. Now, of course, 20/20 hindsight is easy, but at the time when people would hear these reports, they would get very upset. Now, the OSS and many of these State Department advisors had been very critical of Chiang Kai-shek. They felt he was a greedy warlord, that we were sending him millions of dollars in money and we were sending him weapons, and instead of protecting U.S. troops or fighting the Japanese, he was hiding this money and hiding the arms to fight the communists because he wanted to take over China. So many of the reports from these men were very critical, and these men found themselves, as I said, hauled before these committees and told that they had betrayed their country's best interests, that they were soft on communism, that they were traitors, and their careers were ruined. Many of these men were Paul and Julia child's closest friends from their days in China. For example, among these people was Teddy White, Theodore H. White. Most of you know him from the very famous Making of the President series. But Teddy White had been a young reporter covering China for Time magazine, and he'd written his first book, a bestseller called Thunder Out of China. It was very sympathetic to Mao Zedong and the early days of the Communist Revolution and very critical of Chiang Kai-shek. Teddy White was accused of being a traitor. He had his passport revoked. He was branded as treasonous in his views. It took him months to get his passport back. When he finally did, he fled to Paris, where he spent the next couple of years hiding out, trying to avoid the blacklist that was ruining the career of so many other journalists. So Paul and Julia were in the circle in France that was really being persecuted, and they were really seeing one colleague after another have their reputations and their careers destroyed. Now, this was particularly terrifying for Paul Child. As I said, Paul Child was very left-wing. He was an artist. He was very bohemian in his manner of lifestyle and dress. And not only that, he was working for the USIS, the United States Information Service. It was essentially propaganda arm of the State Department. And his job, first in France and then later in Bonn, Germany, where he was posted, was to do essentially anti-communist propaganda, to promote the glories of democracy and capitalism and try and convince Europeans that this was the way to go. So when this anti-communist scare began to spread through the State Department, he felt very vulnerable. It was ratcheted up enormously, of course, by one individual in particular. His name was Joseph McCarthy. One historian noted at the time that Senator McCarthy was a political speculator, and for him, communism was his oil gusher. He found a topic that put him on television every day and front and center, and he went for it all out. He kicked off his anti-communist crusade, as most people remember, with a very famous press conference in Wheeling, West Virginia, in which he brandished a list in front of reporters and said he had in his hand the names of 201 known communists working in the State Department today. That launched an enormous purge of State Department employees at every level and throughout Europe. McCarthy's henchmen started going to the various UIS missions, first in Paris and then in Germany and throughout, interviewing the employees about their backgrounds, doing all kinds of personnel checks, and removing anybody who had the wrong kinds of political views. So Paul Child's colleagues that were supposed to be promoted suddenly found their promotions canceled. People that were supposed to get a good job suddenly were transferred to Siberia, and it was a very tense time. Roy Cohn came through and confiscated books in the USIS libraries that were considered inappropriate. So it was called a de-shelving, one of my favorite words. They took Teddy White's books off the shelves. They took the Maltese Falcon off the shelves. Anything that was declared un-American. It was Paul Child's job to take those books and destroy them, burn them, in fact. And he described it in his diary as soul-destroying work. So he could not have been a tenser time. In 54, actually, their friend Jane Foster, who they were very close to and saw weekly in Paris, had her passport confiscated when she went home to visit her sick mother. This was so common an occurrence at the time that they weren't particularly surprised. She, like Paul, was very left-wing, very outspoken, and a natural target for this kind of political persecution. And Julia and Paul made the difficult but rather brave decision that they would rather defend their friend and their principles than just look the other way, like so many of their colleagues. Julia wrote in her diary that she could not stand to see the people who cringed with fear before McCarthy and Roy Cohn, and that she would be damned if she was one of them. Some of the entries in their letters and diaries during this period are incredibly striking and poignant. They are very afraid. They are very afraid that they are next. They are very afraid for the welfare of their friends. And there is a passage that Julia writes to her father when she realizes that her action in defending her friend Jane Foster might get them into trouble. She says that she wants her father to realize that this decision might mean that he'll read her name in the paper, that she may end up blacklisted, but she feels that she has to make this choice. And to read her make this very agonizing decision and write about it, it's incredibly brave action at the time, and you can't read it without being very impressed. And their fears during this period just mount. And one particular passage was very striking to me. She writes to a friend in 1954, "I am terribly worried about McCarthyism, but what can I do as an individual? It is so frightening. I am ready to bare my breasts, small size though they may be. Stick my neck out. I won't turn my back on anyone. I will sacrifice cat, cookbook, husband, and finally self. But what can I do as an individual?" Not much, the fact was in those days. There was not much you could do. And in fact, they would find that out, because in just a few months after that, Paul Child would receive a telegram summoning him back to Washington. And after several days of wandering the halls of his office in Washington, where nobody will meet his gaze and nobody will tell him why he is there, he will discover that he is going to be subjected to a full loyalty inquiry, as it was known in those days. Somebody had named him as a communist sympathizer. He didn't know who, he didn't know why, but he was now on the FBI's list. He was sat down before two FBI interrogators with a stack of documents this high. They had gone through his records. They had gone back 12 years. They had interrogated all of his neighbors, his friends, his relatives, and his past employers. His FBI file runs hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages. And what you see when you read through it is that if you ask the same questions and over and over and over again, you will get the answers you want. Paul Child was 44 when he was finally married. He taught in boys' schools for years. He taught art. They finally found a crusty old Yankee headmaster who had objected to the fact that he had brought in a live model for the boys to sketch from one day. And he was willing to call into question Paul Child's morals, his sexuality. He was even willing to speculate that perhaps he was a pedophile. Once that was on the record, they asked everybody they interviewed about Paul's sexual leanings, his political leanings. Was he perverted? Was he subverted? It all was, as Paul wrote to Julia, on one slippery scale. In despair one night, he wrote her, "For some verbal fun, try convincing two FBI agents that you are not a lesbian. It can't be done." It sounds incredible today, but it could not have been more terrifying an experience. And I have little doubt that Paul Child would not ever have been cleared and would have had his career destroyed had it not been for the fact that Julia McWilliams' father, John McWilliams, the Pasadena rancher, was a right-wing conservative, very wealthy landholder in California, and one of the early supporters to the Nixon slush fund. They pulled every political string they had to clear Paul, and he was finally cleared for then. But it didn't end there. And they would find themselves, before long, caught up in an incredible FBI investigation into one of the largest spy rings of the 1950s. It was a 14-year investigation, an international investigation. Hoover approved round-the-clock surveillance and something then that was new, which was called, you know, high-tech surveillance. They tapped phones, they opened mail, and Paul and Julia were in the middle of it, all because of their friend Jane Foster. When the French police finally arrested Jane Foster, they found Paul Child's name in her address book. And it just got worse and worse. And I won't give the story away, but obviously my reason in wanting to tell this story was that I was fascinated not only by the story of this group of patriotic young Americans that get swept up in our first intelligence agency and serve their country out of loyalty, but the very unusual political education they had serving in China, one of the most confused theaters of war, where we were caught in the middle of a Chinese civil war, where we as a country had no clear policy, where we tried not to pick sides in that civil war. But suddenly, in 1950s, people who were there, who had had the wrong opinion, who had written a report that was perfectly honest about what they thought they had witnessed, were suddenly being labeled as traitors. This was a very dangerous and confusing time in American history, and Julianne and Paul found themselves caught in the middle of it. And it was fascinating to see the very difficult and very brave choices they made. And most of all, what struck me as so very interesting was that you could have two women from very similar backgrounds in California, and you saw the extent to which character can become destiny, and one would become a beloved American icon and the other a lonely exile in France. Thank you. Now, I'm told that there will be a microphone if anybody has any questions. The gentleman over there on the aisle.
You've written some wonderful books about espionage, not just American espionage. And I wondered how you first got interested in the spy business.
It's a good question. My grandfather was James B. Conant, as you heard earlier, and he was tapped by Roosevelt to be one of the two men that ran the Manhattan Project. The Manhattan Project was all of our wartime laboratories that developed all of the leading weapons of war. That had to do with the submarine technology, proximity fuses, radar technology, and my grandfather was a chemist by training, so his particular purview was the Los Alamos bomb project, and he worked with General Groves in bringing in Robert Oppenheimer and overseeing the development of the bomb. So obviously, my grandfather had a huge FBI file and was followed by the FBI throughout the war. The phone was tapped. Special lines were put into our country house, which was in a remote part of the White Mountains in New Hampshire, so he could have a telephone. There was no telephone, in fact, until then. And his stories when I was growing up later, and many of the men that worked on the bomb were sort of my great uncles in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when I was growing up. Their favorite stories were about all of the crazy snafus with the FBI. And they had some very funny stories. You know, most of the scientists that worked at Los Alamos were refugee scientists from places like, you know, Austria and Germany and Hungary, and they had very thick accents. Some of them spoke virtually no English. And they would be given these elaborate codes to say at the gate, like, you know, how now, brown cow, to get in. And they would get there, and they would say, how now, and then nobody understood them. They couldn't get in, and you would have these people shouting at the gate, I'm Enrico Fermi, let me in, let me in. So they had hilarious stories, and that's just, you know, there were just dozens and dozens of these stories of just everything that could go wrong, stories about the shortcomings of the FBI. Most FBI agents had never left the country. You know, they spoke no foreign languages, and they were really convinced that all of these refugee scientists were nefarious characters because they had thick accents and they dressed funny and they had long hair and beards, and they just thought they were really, really terrible people. And they had a really hard time dealing with the fact that they were supposed to be guarding these guys, and they got a lot of it wrong. As we later found out, because Klaus Fuchs, a very nice, handsome, clean-cut young Austrian, was handing out the bomb secrets in plain sight at a foot of a bridge in Santa Fe. So I you know, listened to these stories growing up, and I got a real appetite for them at a young age. So I think, you know, it started young. Long answer to your question.
Your grandfather was president of Harvard?
James B. Conant, yeah. He took a 5-year leave of absence to run the Manhattan Project. In the back, the gentleman on the aisle.
Thank you for coming to the Free Library and for your insightful comments. I'm curious if you did any research in China regarding Julian Paul's time there and what perspectives, if any, you might have picked up about the Chinese of today attitude toward the American involvement during World War II and post-World War II?
That's a complicated question. In terms of Julia and Paul, I was able to do a lot of research because not only do I have all of their letters and diaries, they were they gave the public a magnificent gift. They gave every piece of paper they had to Harvard, to the Schlesinger Library. It's an incredible archive. And then in addition to that, I was able to get all the OSS papers. And what you see there is that Julia and Paul were actually very aware of what was going on in China and actually had a far more accurate view than most Americans would have. they really understood the level of chaos, the fact that nobody was controlling the warlords in that area, that Chiang Kai-shek, popularity was much greater in America and with the foreign press than it was in his own country, and that he had no control. And they also understood from all of their colleagues that were doing the missions in deep in China and in Indochina that he that Chiang Kai-shek was hoarding weapons. They found weapons caches everywhere, and the state of the nationalist troops was very poor. So they were very aware of the shortcomings, let's put it, of American policy. We were blindly supporting Chiang Kai-shek, and we very much bet on the wrong horse. That said, it was a very confusing time in China, and America had its hands full, and we were trying to avoid getting caught up in that civil war while we were fighting the Japanese. In terms of the Chinese view, I mean, the communists won. We backed Chiang Kai-shek. Needless to say, the Chinese think we got it wrong from day one, and they still do. You know, we are still nominally supporting the democracy in Taiwan. Our relations with the Chinese would be a lot less strained if we didn't continue doing that. It is inevitable that Taiwan will be subsumed by China, but that is a wartime policy that we have not been able to back away from. So it is still a convoluted situation in China.
Hello, good evening. It was a great, great presentation. Okay. You don't have to tell me if you're a spy or not. I don't want to know. I'm joking. I was just curious, was Paul Child really a communist? The reason, I mean, I'm very familiar with that period, and I know that for that period of time, McCarthy might have been a little bit too off. But I feel as an American who's very patriotic and who loves America, even though I was born overseas, and I have, you know, a dual background, if you will. I feel that our country needs people like McCarthy these days. It needs people, and let me, if I may, I know it, some people might be making fun of me. I think this country needs the inspiration of its architects. It needs Donovan, or Donovan, if you will. English is my third language, so pardon my accent. It needs Hoover. Because I fear that next year in 2012, and remember me, and remember that you think what I'm saying is funny, this country is going to lose the dollar value, and we're going to have a one-world currency. So my question for you is, was he really a communist? Because we have communists in Washington these days. And I hope nobody will vote for them next year.
Okay. I'll give a very short answer to your question. Was Paul a communist? In 1955, when he was summoned to Washington, you only had to have accidentally blundered into a cocktail party where there were other communists to be labeled a communist and have it destroy your career. You may have gone to a meeting for a teachers' union in which somebody gave a communist speech. And if your name was recorded as somebody who was present in the audience that day, and remember, on university campuses, students went to all kinds of meetings. If your name was taken down, it didn't matter that 15 years later you had a prominent job in a university, you would be fired. So was he a communist? Who knows? It didn't matter. He was too left-wing. He had too many friends that were left-wing, and he was an artist, and he was unmarried at the age of 44. So he was a dangerous individual with dangerous ideas. And my only response to you would be that if you ever think that demagoguery is a good idea, you do not understand how fragile democracy is, how fragile the right to speak your mind is, how fragile our freedoms are, because demagoguery is the greatest threat and is only a short step from the very dangerous governments we have abroad. Any other questions? The gentleman in the baseball cap.
very proper Republican, Patrick Hurley, a holdover from the Hoover administration, called the communists agrarian reformers. So a lot of people were fooled by them. And other people say the Chinese didn't care about the politics. They worried who gave them the most eat.
The most
rice.
All of that is true. You know, the thing that's hard for most of us to realize is at that time, China was largely run by the warlords in charge of their various principalities, and they were starving in many of those principalities. So you're not wrong. It was a lot about rice. Any other questions? Thank you all for coming tonight. I think I'm supposed to tell you that I'll be signing books upstairs. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.